A few months ago, onto one of the channels in TV, they had a story on there about some natives, and it's so much like we are calling it. These natives had some little monkeys that they love to eat in Africa, and these little monkeys were real small monkeys, and they were fast monkeys. They were hard to catch. And they finally had devised a way to catch them, and what they did, they would cut little holes in the trees, just big enough for the monkey's paw to slide through. And the monkey would slide his paw through these holes, and there was some fruit in there that these monkeys just loved. And when the monkey slid his paw in there, he would grab his fruit. And once he got this fruit in his hand, he could just taste it. I mean, he loved it. And they would not let go of the fruit to pull the hand out, and they would go by and cut their heads off. It was totally impossible for the monkey to let go of it after he got it in his hand. And that's what happens to the alcoholic. When we get to that certain point, and we start thinking about how a few drinks would get gonna make us feel, we can't see we're about to really get our heads cut off with what we're about to do. Because it's a mental blank spot that happens, and we cannot see the truth when once that occurs. So when we get to that point, our defense must come from a higher power.
The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. Mm-hmm. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Now, if you've burned your hand on a hot stove, chances are you're not going to go back and put your hand on that stove again because you remember how it felt the first time. You know, I was a kid growing up, and Joe and I are old enough to go back to the Depression days in the 1930s. And as a kid growing up, we didn't have very much in those days. We didn't have hot and cold running water, and we didn't have forced air heat. In the wintertime, if we had anything to heat with, we were lucky. Wood, coal. Joe said up in Kentucky, where he's from, they used to burn walnuts and said occasionally each other's houses, if necessary, to stay warm. But in the 1930s, even then, it didn't make any difference how poor the family is. Cleanliness is next to godliness. And everybody in the family had to take a bath on Saturday night. Now, whether you need a bath or not is beside the point. You're still going to have to take one on Saturday night. Now, I remember one time in the middle of the winter, Mother had heated the bath water up on the old heating stove in the living room, put it in a number 3 zinc wash tub sitting behind the stove. Oldest kid takes a bath first. Now, I'm the baby of the family. By the time it got to me, the crud would be about an inch thick on it, and Mother would say, "Get in there and get yourself clean." And I'd think to myself, how in the hell did I get clean there? But I didn't dare say that to her. That night she said, "Get in there and get clean." And I scraped the crud back, and I got in that water and began to soak myself, standing right here by this old stove. Stove is red hot. And somehow I accidentally leaned over and stuck my rear against that stove. And I'll never forget it. Raised a blister on my rear end about as big as my hand. Hurt me worse than anything had ever hurt me before. And do you know I've never had an obsession of the mind to stick my ass on a hot stove since then. I never have jerked my britches down, backed up to a stove, and said, "Burn me again." I remember today exactly how that felt. Now, alcohol has burned me over and over and over and over and over, just as bad as that stove ever burned me. And for some strange reason, left on my own resources, my mind cannot remember the pain and the suffering caused by drinking. It always begins to think about that great, exciting, in-control feeling, that great sense of ease and comfort that comes from the first 2 drinks. And that becomes so strong that, just like the monkey, I can't see what alcohol is going to do to me. I can only think about what it's going to do for me. And next thing you know, I think it's okay to drink. And I end up drunk. Page 24, last paragraph. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid unless locked up may die or go permanently insane. Now, if we've placed ourselves beyond human aid, then the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous will not bring about recovery, because it's made up of a group of human beings who are just as powerless as I am. So fellowship alone is not sufficient. Very important, but not sufficient. Page 25. There is a solution.
Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for a successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others. And we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven and have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence we had not even dreamed. He said, the great fact is this, and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experience. He gives us the common solution here as deep and effective spiritual experience. Now, which is this? What does this bring about? Which revolutionizes our attitude toward life, toward ourselves, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our creed has entered our hearts and our lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us we could never do by ourselves. Now, he talks about the whole attitude toward life, toward ourselves, and towards God's universe. He seems to say that this spiritual experience will bring about the psychic change, the thing that Dr. Silkworth was looking for, can be brought about by this spiritual experience. So right here on this page, it tells us about the common solution is the spiritual experience. And at the time that the first, on the big red book, not this book, but the big red book was printed, Bill didn't have an asterisk in here. This page was just like this, except it didn't have an asterisk. It didn't have a note at the bottom of the page. It just told the alcoholic that he had to have a spiritual experience. And it went on with that. After the book was printed and went out over the country, Bill began to get a lot of correspondence from the alcoholics that bought the books. And they was asking Bill, what in the hell is a spiritual experience? You know, here's a poor drunk out there, and just like me, I wasn't well versed in spiritual matters, and here's a guy telling me I had to have a spiritual experience. This seemed like a very lofty thing, something that was told. What are you talking about? What is this spiritual experience? So Bill, when he printed this, the second book was printed, he put an appendix in there. He could see a blind spot in the book for the reader. So he put an appendix in the back of the book to explain what is a spiritual experience. So the reader would have the same idea, see the idea he was trying to convey. So he put an appendix. An appendix is something that is written after the book is finished to make the book more complete. So let's go back to page 569 and see what Bill means by spiritual experience.
Let me tell you what my definition was when I got here.
Yeah.
You know, I was raised in a good old Southern Baptist church.
Yeah.
Now, you guys up here have got Northern Baptist. Down home, we got Southern Baptist. And the good old Southern Baptist church, periodically, they become concerned about how many souls that they're saving for Christ. So every once in a while, they decide to have a revival meeting. Now, a revival meeting is a week-long deal, and you go to church half the day and every night of the week, not just Sunday and Wednesdays like you normally go. And they also go out and bring in an outside preacher. If your preacher was doing good enough, they wouldn't need revival meetings, so they go out and get outside preachers and bring them in. And one night at this revival meeting, I remember this preacher was preaching, and he was good. He was so good halfway through the sermon, you could feel the heat and smell the smoke. That's how good he was. And at the end of the sermon, we have what we call altar call. And those that wish to be saved, they go to the front. They kneel at the kneeling bench. The preacher prays. They pray. Everybody in the place prays. And hopefully they're saved. Well, this particular night, after this preacher had done such a good job, my Aunt Molly, beautiful lady, tall, slender lady, she decided she wanted to be saved. She went to the kneeling bench. She kneels. She's praying. Preacher standing there, hand on her head. He's praying. Everybody in the place is praying. And all of a sudden, Aunt Molly just fell over sideways on the floor. And she began to kick and jerk and tremble all over. And next thing I knew, she jumped up and she began to shout and scream in words and language I'd never heard before. And she began to run back and forth through that church house, jumping over the pew, skirt tail never touching the back of the pew. And I'm about 9 years old, and it scared the living hell out of me. And I turned to my dad and I said, "Dad, what's wrong with Aunt Molly?" And he said, "Son, she's having a spiritual experience." Now, I read on page 25 that I had to have one of them damn things. I said, "There ain't no way I could have one of them." Thank God for the appendix. Thank God for that little asterisk. That little asterisk is the most misunderstood thing in this whole book, and probably one of the most important things. Because without old ideas, I never could have gone for this spiritual experience stuff. If I got to have one, let's go back there and see what it's really going to exist of.
He said the terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening I use many times in this book. Now we're talking about now another term, two terms rather than one. Spiritual experience and spiritual awakening I use many times in this book, which upon careful reading, and I don't know a lot of drunks that do careful reading, that's the trouble, shows that the personality changes, officially bring about recovery from alcoholism, has manifested itself in many different forms. So he's saying the spiritual experience, our spiritual awakening, will produce personality changes good enough to recover, and they will occur in many different forms. You know, we don't have to have the same experience that Bill had. In fact, no one probably will. He said, "Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes, our religious experience, must be in the nature of a sudden spectacular upheaval, happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous." He said in the big red book, "We didn't mean to give you the impression that we all had to have the same sudden change like Bill." Said if we did, we saw it. We didn't mean to for it to come across like that. He said, in the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire immediate, overwhelming God consciousness, followed by a vast change in feeling and outlook. He said, we didn't want you to think that you had to have the same type of change that Bill had. Now he goes on, he says, among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. In the fellowships still yet today, people do still have sudden spiritual experiences. To me, in my observation in later years, and I've been around, I think they still these sudden spiritual experiences are kind of rare. People still have them, but most people don't. Most of our experience are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety. Most of us will not have these sudden spiritual experiences. They're kind of rare. Most of us will have the educational variety. Now let's look at that educational variety. Because they develop slowly over a period of time. One is sudden, like Bill's. The other one occurs gradually over a period of time. As we learn education and apply the steps, we change gradually. In this type of change, quite often friends of the newcomer are aware long before the difference himself. And this was my case. I remember my sponsor telling me, "You're doing all right." And I said, "I ain't doing no good. I couldn't sense no change," but they could see this. And if you're sponsoring somebody, sometimes you can see subtle changes and he can't. Okay. But finally, he finally, himself, like I did, he finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reactions to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about himself alone. What often takes place in a few months, it takes a few months for this, could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource of strength, which they would presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. And as I went through this, I remember the experience of working the steps and seemingly making no progress. Other people said I was doing pretty good. And finally, I became a period of time where I became aware that I had tapped an inner resource of strength in my life. And I then, at that point, I identified this source as a power greater than myself. I had to become aware for it to be complete. So one is fast, the other is slow. Bill in his writing said one was no better than the other. He said both of them produced the same identical thing, a personality change sufficient to recover. Now, when Bill put this appendix in the back of the book, he made the only change that was ever made in the steps since he published them in the book, except to say having had a spiritual awakening, because he knew that more people would have spiritual awakenings rather than spiritual experience. And our steps haven't been changed since he changed that one thing. So we're guaranteed, if we take the steps, to have a spiritual experience which may be sudden, or a spiritual awakening which would be gradually over a few months, to produce the personality changes sufficient to recover.
Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience.
Same thing.
Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but we think these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. And when I got here, I held all spiritual ideas and concepts in contempt. I left the church when I was about 12 or 13 years old, and I vowed then to never have anything to do with God, churches, or church-going people the rest of my life. And my mind had snapped shut against such an idea. Remember, Bill said in his story that his mind had snapped shut against such a theory too. And when I got here, I knew so many things that were wrong about spirituality that it was damn near impossible for me to find out anything new. Thank God my mind finally opened enough to begin to investigate the possibility. And I'm amazed at what I've learned since that time. Now, probably the key word in this whole thing on spiritual experience is the word change.
Change.
You know, Bill had a certain ways of writing, and when you tap into those, it makes it easy to understand his writings. We looked at one thing he did when he talked about God. He used many different names, but always capitalized it. And if you see that, then you know he's talking about God. Otherwise, you think he's talking about somebody else. Another thing that we saw, he loves to use examples of things we already know about to teach us something new. The great ocean liner, the moment after rescue from shipwreck. In the 30s, everybody understood that. They're thinking about the Titanic and etc. Another thing that he does, he repeats himself quite often. But like most writers, when he repeats himself, he'll find a different word that means the same thing, rather than to use the same word over and over. Let's look on page 569. Let's see how many times he said change and how many different ways he said it. About the middle of the first paragraph, he called it a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. In the first sentence in the second paragraph, he again mentioned personality changes. But then he said they're going to be in the nature of a sudden and spectacular upheaval. An upheaval is to change something entirely. In the third paragraph in the first sentence, he said sudden revolutionary changes. Yeah. To revolutionize something is to change it entirely. Third paragraph, last sentence, he talked about immediate and overwhelming. To overwhelm something is to change it. Third paragraph, last sentence, he talked about a vast change in feeling and outlook. Fourth paragraph, first sentence, he said such transformations. To transform is to change. Fourth paragraph, about the middle of the paragraph, he called it a profound alteration. To alter is to change. So the key here is to change from what we used to be. Restless, irritable, discontented, filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse, to a person who can be sober and has some peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. And we do that by discarding old ideas and beginning to operate on new ideas. And then we can find the peace of mind necessary for sobriety. And we can call that anything we want. A psychic change, a personality change, a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening, they all mean exactly the same thing. To change to what God wants me to be. You know, I used to think He wanted me to change into something I wasn't. To change into maybe like somebody else. But today I think what God wants me to do is to change to what He wanted me to be in the first place. And if I can ever change to that, then I can find that peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. Let's go back to page 25 now for just a moment. Last paragraph.
If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And we have passed in a region from which there is no return through human aid. We had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our terrible situation as best we could.
Step one.
And the other is to accept spiritual help.
Step two. And you're going to see Bill repeating that statement over and over as we go through the book.
He's preparing us for the decision that we're going to be making when we get to step three. He's given the alternatives to make that decision.
A lot of people today say, well, you better not talk too much about God or you'll run the newcomer off. And if you'll notice, the big book doesn't mind talking about God and spirituality, and it finally gets around to telling us we got one or two choices. Stay powerless, continue to drink until we die, or accept spiritual help. And it looks like that's the only two choices that we've got. My old sponsor helped me out in this area. He said, Charlie, you don't need to worry about running a newcomer off talking about God. He said, if you do, whiskey will put him right back in here. He said, he has no other place to go. And when he gets out there and drinks some more and hurts some more, he'll be back. And then he'll probably be ready to talk about God. And I found that to be absolutely true. And we just have one or two choices. Now, we saw where the idea of the illness, the information for step one, the physical allergy and the obsession of the mind, we saw where that came from. That came from a doctor in New York City called Dr. Silkworth. Now let's see if we can see where the idea of the spiritual experience came from. And this absolutely blows my mind when I look at this thing, to see where this idea really did come from. Now you would think it would have come from church people or highly religious or spiritual people. Let's see where it came from.
A certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character.
Now this is Roland Hazard. John talked about him. He's the guy that had plenty of money.
He had floundered from one sanatorium to another. He consulted the best-known American psychiatrist, then going to Europe, placing him in the care of the celebrated physician and psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. And like we say, he didn't stay there for 28 days. He stayed in doctor's care for a whole year, and he treated him. His physical and mental condition were usually good. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge, the inner workings of his mind, the hidden springs, that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffled, he could not give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to the doctor, another trip to Zurich, Switzerland, whom he admired, and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. Now, the doctor said, in the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society. He would have to place himself on a lock and key. I hired a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was a great physician's opinion. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he a good fan. He can go in on earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Now, some of our alcoholics may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of our conversation our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. You know, chronic, you know, just means more than once. You do it more than once, you're probably chronic. You know, I mean, we're all in that condition when we get here. He said, I've never seen one single case recover where the state of mind is the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exceptions? The doctor said, yes, replied the doctor, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. He says, here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have what are called vital spiritual experiences. He said, to me, these occurrences are a phenomenon. I don't understand them. Even as a psychiatrist, I see them, but I can't explain how they happen. It's unexplainable to him. He said, they appear to be in the nature of a huge emotional displacements and rearrangements.
Change.
Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which once the guiding forces of these lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side.
Change.
And a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them.
Change.
In fact, I've been trying to produce such emotional rearrangements within you.
Change.
With many individuals, the method I have employed are successful, but I have never been as successful with an alcoholic of your description. You see another asterisk, and it says, for application, see Appendix 2. You know, this doctor told Roland, I've never been as successful with alcoholics. This man had great humility. He was one of the best in the world. He didn't have to be that way. But he was one of the best in the world. And he admitted to Roland that I can't help you, Roland. And Roland asked him, is there any exceptions to cases like mine? He said, oh, yeah, man. He said, sure. People like you have recovered. See, I don't understand it. I've never been able to do it, he said, but they have what I call vital spiritual experiences. We look back at this given time, you know, it's possibly the only place that this could, these spiritual experiences were taking place. Every once in a while, people were getting sober, alcoholics were getting sober, having spiritual experiences in the church.
Probably
in a church. Now here was a great psychiatrist, one of the best in the world, who dared go beyond. He deals with the mind, but he went beyond his experience and gave Roland a spiritual tooth. Right? He said, I can't help you. And he gave this to Roland. It's highly possible that he suggested that Roland get involved in the Oxford group. He might be a way for him to do this. Roland left Zurich, Switzerland, came back to New York and got involved in the Oxford groups. And through using their little plan program of action, he had a spiritual experience. And he stayed sober. 2 years later, he heard about Abby getting ready to be trying to put Abby in a nut house. Abby was about to go to jail. And Roland went to the court and got Abby, took him to his house, put him through the little plan program of action. Took him into New York City after 2 weeks, put him to work at Sam Schumacher's Mission, working with other alcoholics. And while he was there, he thought he was went down on Wall Street one day, heard about Bill, and he said, I believe I'll call Bill up and see if he's interested in this little solution and this plan program of action. Bill already had the problem, and Abby brought him the solution, the vital spiritual experience, and the program of action, and Bill applied it to his life. And as we always say, when Abby walked in the kitchen, this is where the problem found the solution, because Bill already had the problem, and Abby brought him the solution and the plan of recovery. It's very strange how all these ideas were made together. You know, Dr. Silkworth was in New York. Dr. Carl Jung had the solution, the vital spiritual experience in Zurich, Switzerland. And how these ideas came through Roland and Abby to Bill's mind. Bill said, my mind was a vessel to gather these ideas from other people. They weren't Bill's ideas. They came from Silkworth. Bill and Abby and Roland was just instruments to gather these things and to put them together. See, Dr. Silkworth knew the problem in New York City, but he didn't know the solution. He knew the solution was psychic change, but he didn't know how to bring the psychic change about. Dr. Carl Jung was in Zurich, Switzerland, and he knew the solution was a psychic change, but he didn't understand the problem.
He knew it was a spiritual experience.
Yeah. He didn't understand the problem. He just knew it was about the spiritual experience. Now, neither of these people knew the plan of action to find the solution. That was the Oxford groups. The Oxford groups knew the plan of action to have a spiritual experience, and they didn't understand the problem or the solution. It was Bill's mind was the first mind. Bill's mind was a vessel to gather these ideas from Silkworth, Jung, and the Oxford groups. And to conceive, God used him to conceive these ideas within his mind. And uniquely what he did also was put these ideas into words that alcoholics could understand. See, because these were the psychiatrists and religious people, take their language and put it into language for the alcoholic. So we, you know, this is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, that these ideas came together from all diverse places. Remember the doctor and a psychiatrist and a group of fundamental Christians, and it was molded together to make a program for alcoholics. This is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Dr. Jung could have said, Roland, I believe you're suffering from a Valium deficiency. Let me write you a prescription. You keep coming back, and we'll treat you for another year. But he was great enough and had enough humility to admit defeat and said, this can't do anything more for you. There is one possible way, though. Through spirituality. Now the story goes, you know, Dr. Jung and Dr. Adler were both students of a fellow named Dr. Freud, and those three were the three well-known psychiatrists at that time. And the story goes that Roland had tried to get to Freud first, and Freud was sick and wasn't taking on any more patients. And he tried to get to Adler, and Adler was too busy. Jung was really the third choice. Now, Jung had fallen out with Adler and Freud on one thing and one thing only. Adler and Freud thought that all answers would lie within the mind itself. And Jung thought that some answers might come through spirituality. Thank God he got to Jung and didn't get to Freud or Adler. If he had, we'd be sitting around today trying to psychoanalyze ourselves out of this deal.
You're still trying to.
And some of the groups are trying it today. You see that quite often. And I think it might well do us well to remember that all the facets of the 12-step program came from non-alcoholic people. Now, Silkworth was non-alcoholic. Jung was non-alcoholic. The Oxford groupers were a group of people practicing first century Christianity, basically all non-alcoholic people. So everything you and I use today came from people outside of this fellowship. We didn't think of any of them. And it might be well for us to remember that. I think that's all we've got for tonight. Thank you all for being here. Our spokesperson has a...
Good morning, everybody. My name is Charlie Parman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Charlie.
Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found necessary to take a drink for 9,516 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. Hey, you guys look great this morning.
Monday.
Yeah.
They look good.
Joe leaned over here a while ago and he said, Charlie, this is the best looking bunch of sick people I've seen in a long time.
Good looking bunch of sick people.
Got good.
Okay, my name is Joe and I'm a real alcoholic. Through God's grace and because this program works, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink today. For this, I'm extremely grateful. Again, it's good to be back for Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. As Charlie said, we usually tell a little story and just get these things started, relax us, and you probably don't need to be relaxed. I was sitting over by that fireplace and the meeting started, and it dawned on me, if you can't get serenity here, you're something really bad wrong with you. But this guy, we always tell stories about alcoholics. And this alcoholic went to the doctor, and he had his ears burnt real bad. This blisters and everything, both of his ears were just terribly burnt. And the doctor, he went to see the doctor, and the doctor said, God, boy, look at you. Your ears are in terrible shape. Well, he said, I burned him. He said, how did you do that? He said, well, Doc, he said, you know, I drink a little. About two beers, you know. And he said, you know, I come home in the evening and have dinner and stuff. Then I go in my living room with my bottle and I sit and I start drinking. And I'd like to drink and sit
there. Lean back in the recliner.
Lean recliner, watch TV. And he said, my wife, every once in a while, she wants to talk to me, and she knows what I'm doing, and she comes in where I'm at. And so the other night, she came in talking to me, and she was doing an ironing, and she brought an ironing board in. And she was standing beside me, my back big chair, and she was ironing. And I was drinking, watching TV. And so the telephone rang, and I reached up to get the telephone, and I grabbed the iron, and I burnt my ear. And the doctor said, well, that accounts for one ear. How did you burn the other one? He said, the damn fool called back.
Turn that picture up.
Before we get into Chapter 3, we've got a little picture here that kind of reviews or shows us where we left off last night. We had finished up with Chapter 2, What is the Solution? And we could see that for those of us who are powerless, the solution would lie within power. And we talked about the power of the fellowship which supports us. And we talked about the power of the vital spiritual experience, which changes us. And we said if we could receive the power from those two sources, then that should be sufficient to overcome our powerlessness over alcohol. And on the left-hand side of the sheet, we see the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the older members, through the sharing of their experience, strength, and hope with the newcomer, provides enough strength for the newcomer to be able to stay sober for a period of time. And of course, it's a two-way street. As the older member supports the new member, the older member draws strength from that too. Always helping others helps us. Now, it would be almost impossible to be in AA today for very long and not begin to believe that there's some kind of power, greater than human power, working within this fellowship. When you hear dozens and then hundreds and then literally thousands of people saying that it's only by the grace of God, or because of God as I understand Him, or because of the power greater than I am, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink an X number of days, weeks, months, years, or whatever. You just can't hardly hear that over and over and over and not begin to believe there's probably some kind of power greater than human power working within this fellowship. When the newcomer begins to believe that, then that opens the mind up, and the newcomer becomes willing to investigate. And upon investigation, they find that simple kit of spiritual tools, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through the working and the practice of those steps, they have a personality change sufficient to recover, revolutionizes their whole attitude toward life, toward their fellows, and etc. And when that happens to them, they become an older member. Then they can go back to the left-hand side of the sheet and support the next newcomer that comes in. Now you'll notice on this drawing we're basing older membership not on how long we've been sober, but upon the quality of that sobriety. And only those that have had a vital spiritual experience, a personality change, can help another to have one too. Now, used to, when AA first started, everybody worked the steps. There was never any question about this. And if a newcomer didn't want to work the steps, they simply said, well, you need to leave us alone. You need to get out of here, because there's nothing we can do to help you unless you're willing to work the steps and have this spiritual experience. So it was an established fact that everybody worked the steps. But somewhere down the line, as we began to start staying sober on fellowship, less and less staying sober on the program, the quality of the sobriety began to change. And as the quality of the sobriety began to change, then they had to start measuring success. Not by the quality of your sobriety, but by how long have you been sober. And slowly, slowly, we went from a life-changing program to a non-drinking program. And we began to look at the one who had been sober the longest as the most successful. But you'll notice today in AA, you see all kinds of people. You know, you see some people in AA that's only been sober about 6 months. They were real lucky. They got a good sponsor. They got right into the steps. They've worked the steps. They've had a spiritual experience. And they are a delight to behold. God, you just love to be around them. They're always laughing and cutting up and having fun. They're always helping AA and other people. And you really like to be around them. Haven't been sober long, but they got good quality sobriety. Then you see some people that have been sober 8, 9, 10 years. They've treated it like a cafeteria. They took what they wanted and they left what they wanted. They're better than they used to be. But you never really know what kind of shape they're going to be in the next time you see them. One day they're up and the next day they're down. They're kind of like a yo-yo. Then you see some people in AA that's been sober 18, 19, 20 years. Never worked a step. Damn proud of it. And they're the ones that grit their teeth and say, if you want what we've got and willing to go to any damn lengths to get it,
Now, some of those guys, you'd like to buy them a drink. You know they would feel better if they had a good drink. So we're not talking about how long we've been sober. We're talking about the quality of the sobriety. And only those that have had the spiritual experience can help the next one to have one. Okay, Joe?
Okay. As we come back, as we start again, and there is a solution, we finish. And as Bill was writing these chapters, remember, he's using conveying the ideas in a sequence to help us arrive to the conclusion. We look at chapter 2 already, and it gave us a solution. And it defined the solution, this as we looked on this chart, as power. And it, we can surely say this is precise, specific, clear-cut direction, because our steps, you know, don't leave any doubt of what we're talking about. And he said, and we've defined that power as the power of the fellowship and the power of the spiritual experience in chapter 2. Chapter 2 clearly defines what that power is. Now, step 2 always also says, what specifically do we want that power to do? Right? We want that power to restore us to sanity. Now, more about alcoholism is going to deal with that specific area. You know, it's going to talk about the insanity of alcoholism. You know, a lot of us, we need to understand that, and this does a beautiful job in showing us the insanity of alcoholism.
If we are insane, yeah. If we got to be restored to sanity, then that in itself indicates that we must be insane. Now, a lot of people in AA, they have no difficulty with this. They say, oh, I don't have any problem with that insanity, because I remember all the crazy, stupid things I did while drinking. Other people are highly offended by the idea of insanity. They say, oh, don't tell me I'm insane. Oh, yeah, I do some crazy, stupid things while drinking, but when I'm sober, I'm like other people. Now, in either case, they're referring to what we do when drunk as the insanity. And that's not the insanity. The crazy, stupid things we do while drunk is caused by alcohol itself. It enters the mind, it lowers the inhibitions. And if you are drinking alcohol and it's lowered your inhibitions, look out, you're going to do some pretty crazy, stupid things, all right. But that's caused by alcohol itself. Now, in order for us to understand the insanity, we first had to find out, well, what is sanity? And again, we had to go to the dictionary to find this out. And you look up the word sane or sanity in the dictionary. It's defined as wholeness of mind or completeness of mind. A mind that is whole, a mind that is complete, can usually see the truth about everything around it. And it makes decisions based upon truth. And life turns out to be pretty good. An insane mind is one that is less than whole. And a mind that is less than whole cannot always see the truth about everything around it. And sometimes it will make a decision based upon a lie, and then it runs into difficulty. To be insane does not mean you're crazy. If you're crazy, that means you've lost more than half your marbles. And you got to be locked up somewhere to protect you and society from you. That is not insanity. That's to be crazy. I think one of the best ways to illustrate it is, let's take a pie and set it here in front of us. And let's cut that pie into 10 pieces. And you come along and we give you a piece of pie. Well, my pie is now less than whole, but I've still got 90% of it. Somebody else comes along and we give them a piece of pie. Our pie is now more or less than whole, but we still got 80% of it. Insanity does not mean you're all gone. It just means you're not quite all here. And when it comes to alcohol, from time to time it seems as though we are not quite all here, because we can't always see the truth about alcohol. So our mind is less than whole, less than complete. When it comes to alcohol, and alcohol only, that's all we're looking at now. Can we or can we not see the truth about alcohol? Now, Bill is going to, in this chapter, give us a series of examples. This is the way he loves to teach any of by examples. He's going to talk about the man of 30. He's going to talk about Jim. He's going to talk about the jaywalker. And he's going to talk about Fred. And each time we're going to look into the mind just before we take the first drink. Not after, just before. Can we or can we not see the truth? Just before we take the first drink, we are stone cold sober. So let's begin to look at this. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he's bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow someday he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. Now look out. Once again, in these two paragraphs, we see Bill repeating himself over and over, but using different words when he does. First, he used the word obsession. And we all know that an obsession is an idea that is so strong that it can make you believe something that is not true. So if you've got an obsession that is strong enough to make you believe something that's true, then your mind is less than complete. He said the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Now we all know what an illusionist is. An illusionist is a magician. And a magician can stand in front of you and with sleight of hand and a few props make you believe something that is not true. So obsession and illusion mean the same thing. To believe something is not true or to believe a lie. The second paragraph, he said, the delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. The word delusion means the same thing. If you've deluded yourself, that means you've allowed yourself to believe something that's not true. So you may see one of four words, all meaning the same thing.
Okay.
Insanity, obsession, illusion, or delusion, and they all mean exactly the same thing. A mind that is less than whole, a mind that cannot see the truth about something. So let's look and see if we can see the obsession, the illusion, the delusion, the insanity in these examples.
Okay.
Let's go over to page 32, second paragraph, A Man of 30.
Now remember, we're looking at the state of the mind just before we drink. A lot of people talk about the insanity after we drink. The insanity is before we take the first drink. We cannot take the first drink on the truth. Right? So it's got to be a lie. We got to believe a lie, which could be called an illusion, a delusion, insanity, or obsession. But it's to believe a lie, to believe something that is not true. See, I can't go and leave here and go over to the bar this morning on the truth. If I did, I would have to leave here walk over the street to the bar and say, "Mister, I drank some of that 33 years ago, and it damn near killed me. I spent all my money. My wife left there, and I ended up locked up in the nut house." Right? Now this morning I got some money. I would like to buy some more of that to do the same thing. You know, you know, you really can't go in there on that, see? That's the truth, right? I would have to say, this time it's not going to bother me. This time it's, you know, it's going to be different. I would have to believe something that's not true. So we're going to look at these people and see what they believed just before they drank.
In order for Joe to drink today, he would have to believe what this man of 30 had to believe.
Yeah.
Let's look at the man of 30 and see what he believed.
The man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to see it in business, but saw he'd get nowhere if he drank it all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. We can see he had the craving. He made up his mind to be successful in business and retired. He would not touch another drop. Now, he was an exceptional man. He was able to do this. He remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at age 55. After a happy, successful business career, he fell victim to a belief. This is what he believed, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men.
He believed something that's not true.
Not true. Now, based on his belief, out came his carpet slippers in the bottle, and in 2 months he was in a hospital puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital in the meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Couldn't stop again. Every means of solving his problem which money could buy was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces and was dead within 4 years. Now, this case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us believe if we remain sober for a long stretch, we'll get thereafter drink normally. But here is a man who at 55 years found he was just where he left off at 30. And then we see, he says, "We have seen the truth, demonstrated again and again, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. If we plan to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking motion that someday we will be immune to alcohol." Now, if we can see what this man did, what killed this man, it wasn't the allergy to alcohol. That could have never hurt him if he hadn't believed something that was not true. He believed a lie, and he made a decision and took some action based on a lie. And we know there's a principle that never changes. If you make a decision and take an action based on a lie, you will always run into the truth.
And the truth just stands there like a sword, just waiting to cut your head out.
That's right. It's never going to change. The truth will always be there.
Now, is this guy's real problem the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol, or the fact that he has a form of insanity, an illusion, a delusion, an obsession that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol after 25 years of sobriety? Now, when he believed that and made his decision to drink, he was stone cold sober. So once again, this reinforces chapter 2. The real problem of the alcoholic centers in our mind, telling us we can drink rather than in our body, which ensures that we can't drink. Page 34, second paragraph. "For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then should we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Now, our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. Now, Joe just loves old Jim. Gets a little screwed up with him once in a while. Let's see what he can do with Jim this morning, Joe.
Yeah, I do. I don't know. Every time I read this, I think about this guy. He's my main man. Me and him think a lot alike, you know. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He has a commendable worldwide record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him.
Typical alcoholic.
You know, everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He didn't know drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violently intoxicated he had to be committed. Right? Had to put him in. On leaving the treatment center, he came into contact with us, and they changed the name of those places now. Same thing, they changed the name.
They call them treatment centers today.
Used to be asylums.
And okay. They'll let you in and out. Used to, they wouldn't do that. You can today. They quit hydrotherapy, too. They don't use that anymore.
Okay. Now, let's see what happened. Now, we told him what we knew about alcoholism.
They told him about step one.
And the answer we had found.
They told him about step two.
And he made a beginning.
A little later on in the book, we're going to see where step three is but a beginning. So apparently Jim took steps one, two, and three.
Yeah.
And immediately things began to get better.
We see people coming in today taking three steps and quitting, right? That's what old Jim did. He was a three-stepper. Okay, and let's see what he did. His family was reassembled. He began to work as a salesman for the business he lost through drinking. All went well, but he failed to enlarge on his spiritual life.
And again, later on in the book, we're going to see the only way you enlarge upon step three is through 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. He didn't take any of those, just 1, 2, and 3.
For his consternation, he found himself drunk a half a dozen times in rapid succession. Jim got drunk 6 times real quick. On each occasion, we worked with him. Now, these were good AA members in those days. They went over and worked with Jim every time he got drunk.
6 times.
I doubt if they fooled with you 6 times now, but they did with Jim. Okay. He agreed he was a real alcoholic in serious condition. He knew he'd face another trip to the treatment center if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, whom he had deep affections. Yet he got drunk again, now this 7 times. They're getting tired of fooling with Jim, you know. They said, now Jim, this is 7 times you got drunk. We're getting kind of tired of this. This, how are you getting drunk? What is happening with you? We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. He said, I came to work on Tuesday morning. Chai and I studied the book many years before we saw this. Where was Jim Monday? You know, we're bad about Mondays. It didn't say Tuesday, didn't it?
Yeah. A little humor in the book once in a while. Old Bill had a sly sense. And every once in a while he sticks it in here.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to look in Jim's mind, and we're going to see where he went from sane to insane thinking, from normal to abnormal thinking. Let's see exactly what happened to Jim.
I remember I felt irritated. I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned.
Now, I think that's normal. Probably anybody that had to be a salesman for a concern they once owned, that's probably normal thinking.
Then I decided, I had a few words with boss, but nothing serious.
Boss probably said, "Say, Jim, by the way, where were you all day yesterday anyhow?" Nothing real serious, just enough to get him irritated.
Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car.
Now, apparently this guy is a car salesman. What would be more normal? He's had a few words with the boss. He's a little irritated. He wants to get away from the shop for a while. So he's going to drive out in the country and see somebody he already knows to sell a car to him. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they had a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich.
What's more normal than if you're hungry? To want to get a sandwich. We stopped in at a place where they have a bar, but the bar is beside the point because we have no intention of drinking. We're just going to get a sandwich because we're hungry. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
I also had a notion I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, but I've been going to it for years and eating there many times during the months I was sober.
What's more normal than to think, while I'm in there, I might find another customer, and I might sell a car while I'm in there? Now, I'm not going in there to drink. I'm going there to get a sandwich because I'm hungry, and I'm going to try to sell a car. I've eaten there many times during the months I'm sober. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
I sat down at the table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk.
What's more normal than if you're hungry? To sit down at a table and order a sandwich and a glass of milk. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk.
Now, if you're hungry enough, there's nothing wrong with two sandwiches and two glasses of milk. Unless you're a member of Overeaters Anonymous, then you better look at it close. But this would be normal thinking for this alcoholic car salesman, to have two sandwiches and two glasses of milk. Now comes the squiggly writing.
Suddenly the thought crossed my mind. If I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
Now this is absolute insanity. For Jim to believe that he can take an ounce of whiskey, mix it with milk, and it won't hurt him on a full stomach. Now, based on the insane idea, he makes a decision and takes some action.
I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart. I felt assured I was taking the whiskey and tried another. Thus started one more journey to the treatment center for Jim. There was a stretch of commitment, the loss of family physician, say nothing of the intense mental and physical suffering what drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in a favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Now, whatever precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. Now he gives us a definition. How can such a lack of proportion of the bill to be think straight be called anything else? Insanity is lack of our ability to think straight.
About alcohol.
Our particular case, we lack the ability to think straight about alcohol on our own. Okay.
Now, is Jim's real problem the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol, or that he has a form of insanity, an illusion, a delusion, or an obsession that tells him, I can drink alcohol if I mix it with milk and put it on a full stomach? The real problem centers in the mind. T. telling us we can drink, rather than the body that ensures that we can't. Page 37, last paragraph.
Another example.
Our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. Now, I don't understand this guy, but I can see. In fact, I thought about him a while ago. We walked over to the little general store and crossed, and a big truck came down through there. And I could just see this guy standing there waiting for that truck. And that truck gets up there close to him, and he jumps out in front of it. Spins around two or three times, sees how close the truck can come to hitting him without actually hitting him. For some reason, he gets a thrill out of that. I don't understand him, but I can see him do it. Now, he enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. People say, hey, Jack, you better stop that. You're going to get hurt. He pays no attention to them. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him when he's slightly injured several times in succession. He's getting a little older now. He can't move as fast. They begin to hit him once in a while. Nothing serious, he just kind of bounces off of them. Now you would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. But presently he's hit again, this time has a fractured skull. He got hurt bad this time.
Yeah.
Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. He gets hurt bad again. Now he sings their anthem. He tells you he's decided to stop jaywalking for good. He said, man, I'm through with this jaywalking. I'm tired of these fractured skulls, broken arms. I'll never do it again. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. On through the years, his conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. Finally, he can no longer work. He's just so beat up now, he can't hold a job. His wife gets a divorce. She's tired of supporting him, the kids, the hospital bills, and everything else. And he's held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. Not his body, his head. He shuts himself up in a treatment center, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't it? Now, you may think our illustration is too ridiculous. But is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we've been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? I think that's so appropriate today. You know, again, because of education, many, many people are getting to us before they have to lose everything. Once in a while, you see somebody come in here that's still married. Occasionally, one comes in and they've still got a job. Believe it or not, I saw one come in a couple of weeks ago and he still had his automobile. And we start talking about insanity to those people. And they say, man, don't tell me I'm crazy. I haven't lost my job. I've got my spouse. I've still got my car. No, we're not talking about those things. We're talking about one thing and one thing only. Can we or can we not see the truth about alcohol? If we can, we're sane. If we can't, we're insane. Now, later on, I realized that when I got to AA, I wasn't too swift in a hell of a lot of areas. But right here at the beginning, we're looking about alcohol and alcohol only. Now, some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. It amazes me how appropriate these words are today. We admit we have some of these symptoms. We've not gone to the extremes you fellas did, nor are we likely to. For we understand ourselves so well of what you've told us that such things cannot happen again. We've not lost everything in life through drinking. We certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. Now that may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. We talked about the heavy drinker already. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize. to smash home upon our alcoholic readers as has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another illustration.